this meeting to order for the Mint Borough City Council on this day, Tuesday, October 15th, 2013. And I'd like to ask Liz to take roll call, please.
Certainly. Council members present and establishing a quorum are Gehring, Cuddaback, Williams, Camp, Davis, Gamble, and Hamper.
Thank you very much. Normally, at this time, I lead in the Pledge of Allegiance, but I'd like to recognize some gentlemen who are here from Troop 38, the Scouts. Always appreciate when they join us at our City Council meetings. And I'd also like to ask Sam from Troop 38 if you'd come forward and lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance, please.
Of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, sir. And again, welcome to those members of Troop 38 who are here today, tonight, in attendance. All right. We have a public hearing scheduled this evening. This is an interim code, a sign code regulation. We will be taking public testimony as well as a possible motion to extend the interim sign code. With that, I'd like to ask Paul, if you'd give us a little bit more background, please. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mayor. Tonight for a public hearing, we're asking Council to extend the interim regulations you adopted last April for 6 months. I should tell you, it's our intent to finish this code and adopt permanent regulations before the end of the year. But before we can consider extending, we do need to have a public hearing to hear if anyone has any testimony to offer, any comments to offer. We've been working on this for the last, two, 3 months, and with the intention of fixing several things. We have a pretty good list of fixes, and we've come up with a few more, and we just haven't quite completed the work we need to be ready to go with permanent regulations. And we also need to take a little time to put together an enforcement program to figure out some protocol and how we're going to handle enforcement of the code once it's permanently adopted. It's our intent to go out and actively enforce consistently to bring people into conformance. That's about it for me. Any questions I can take before we open the public hearing?
Councilmember Cuddaback.
Thank you. Paul, how is enforcement of the interim code going? Are we doing enforcement of that with boards and other things? Just curious. I've had some questions about that in the community.
We've not been doing active, proactive enforcement during the interim period.
Okay.
The postcard we sent out to all the businesses last April indicated that there was a six-month grace period. Mm-hmm. And we've only responded in case where we get an actual complaint on a specific sign problem. But once the permanent regs are adopted, it's always been the intent that enforcement would follow the permanent regs.
Okay.
But to date, no.
Okay. And I know we had talked about a little bit when we were looking at the sign code, that enforcement, you know, how easy or hard was it going to be to enforce some of the regulations. So do you have any sense of that? Are you getting much complaints about some of the stuff? Or do you think, because you have listed here some of the issues that have popped up. I didn't see anything about enforcement. Obviously, you're not doing enforcement during this interim, but do you think that that's going to be a possible problem after the permanent code is adopted?
I don't think it will be a problem in terms of our ability to enforce and having the code to back us up. And there are a couple things we're working on in that regard, so that we do have clear backing as to what we're requesting the owners to do. I think we'll have a bigger problem in simply in pushback of, I've had this sign here, this A-board, I've had this banner for so long, and now you're telling me I have to take it down. But, you know, we've had some publicity, and we did the postcards, and we're trying to talk to people as we go along. And I think the key will be in enforcing, not getting out of hand and going through the community, taking down signs, but in a consistent and reasonable way, working with people to say, okay, you've got a problem here, let's figure out how to solve it. Give me some time to take care of this, but we're going to stay on it and track it. And it'll take a little time, but I think we'll reach a state of equilibrium with the code and what's out there.
Thank you.
All right, seeing no other lights, then we'll open this time for comments or testimony from citizens. And I don't have anyone signed up at this time to address council and to provide public testimony. But as always, if there's someone in the audience who would like to address this particular issue, you may do so by approaching the podium, providing your name and address for the record, and I ask that you limit your time to 5 minutes. All right, seeing nobody at this time approaching the podium, I would entertain a motion to close the public testimony portion of the public hearing.
So moved.
Second.
Motion's been made by Councilmember Williams and seconded by Councilmember Cutterback to close the public testimony portion of the public hearing. No lights, no comments. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Paul, you were looking for something here this evening. The recommended actions.
Yes, we are looking for a first and final action to extend for 6 months and give us just another couple of months to finish what we've started. And looking for your endorsement of that extension tonight.
Councilmember Hanford.
Yes, thank you. I read everything as far as why you're asking for waiving the council rules of procedure for the second reading of the ordinance. I just was wondering if there's any reason that did this just sneak up on us and we didn't realize it, or does it really matter if there's a week in between, you know, if we were to wait until next week? I read everything, but I'm trying to sense the urgency.
Yeah, the urgency is that it does expire later this month, and we want to be sure and take action prior to the expiration. It's actually the 21st. We're coming right down to the wire with this tonight. That would, or actually would extend it up to 6 months, let's say our intent is to complete this before the end of the year.
Sure. So it just snuck up on us, and then we're here, we've got to get it done quick.
Well, it didn't exactly sneak up on us so much as that we all along had planned to finish this and bring it to you for final approval, you know, last week for final approval and this week, but it got waylaid by several other projects. It's been,
well, you've been
very, very, very busy lately.
You've been really busy.
I'm afraid the sign code had to take a back seat.
Yeah. But yeah, as we've talked about before, I don't like waiving rules of procedure. However, tonight I see that it would make sense that we do that. So I'll make a motion to waive council rules of procedure requiring second reading of ordinance.
Second.
All right, motion's been made by Councilmember Hamford, seconded by Councilmember Gearing to waive council rules of procedure requiring second reading of ordinance. Any other questions or comments? Then we'll take a vote on the motion. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Thank you.
That's the first motion. Second motion. If there was one, Councilmember Gary.
I think I move to accept as first and final reading ordinance number 1014-2013, bringing the interim zoning regulation adopted under ordinance number 002-2013, codified chapter 1880 MMC, signs, adopting findings in support thereof, providing for severability and establishing an effective date.
Second.
Motion has been made by Councilmember Gary and seconded by Councilmember Davis. As read, I will ask the city attorney. read the official ordinance title at this time.
City of Monroe, Ordinance Number 014-2013, an ordinance of the City of Monroe, Washington, renewing the interim zoning regulation adopted under Ordinance Number 002-2013 and codified as MMC Chapter 1880, Signs, relating to the display of signage, adopting findings in support thereof, providing for severability, and establishing an effective date.
Thank you very much. Any other questions or comments for the audience or questions of Paul? All right, seeing no lights, hearing no comments, we will take a vote on the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dan.
Paul.
Thanks, Paul. We'll be back with normal procedures next time.
Very good.
Thank you.
At this time, we have set here, Councilmember Gable. No, we did not. We did not close the public hearing.
Close the citizen portion.
We're good?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah, we're good. All right. This time in our agenda this evening is set aside for comments from citizens. This is an opportunity for you, the public, to speak to council on any subject other than a subject matter that is subject to a public hearing. I ask that you please provide your name and address for the record and limit your time to 5 minutes. I have no one signed up, but I do have someone who I know would like to address us, and that's Mark.
I signed the wrong paper. He said, we don't really want to test the plan to sign. My name is Mark Auden. For those of you who don't know me, I know most of you. I'm running on my 8th year as the executive director of the East County Senior Center in Monroe, and I'd like to come before you at least once here to tell you what's going on and talk to you specifically about our bus program. We've got a great senior center. It's growing. I don't know how many of you are aware of this, but your senior center received a national award from the National Council on Aging 2 years ago. I flew back to Washington, D.C. to pick it up for a joint project we did with the high school. Called the senior and emergency, bragging about it, and emergency preparedness and just changing attitudes, having the two groups of seniors in high school and senior citizens working together to build. We wound up building 100 emergency preparedness kits that we distributed at the food bank. So it was a great project and was deemed worthy on a national level. So, and right now we're working on trying to attract the boomer generation to the senior center, because senior center, it's a national issue. Senior centers won't survive if boomers don't start coming. So Tuesday night, we have what we call our boomer program. We publish something called the Boomerang. I don't know if any of you have seen that. And something's going on right now. A class on photography is going on right now. But specifically coming to talk to you about our bus. We're really appreciative of all the past support you've given us, and hopefully you'll maintain at least that level in the future, if not see fit to provide a small increase. You all see our bus driving around town. It's not just driving around town for joyrides. In the last 2 years, our ridership has increased 59%. Last year, I've got statistics in front of me, close to 2,000 rides were given. It's on a three-day-a-week basis, so in 3 days a week. And it's not just people going to visit their friends. Like every Monday morning, at 11 o'clock, we go next door to the Village East Apartments, and we have a list of between 6 to 10 people that we drop off at Fred Meyer or Safeway or businesses downtown. Your money helps support commerce in the city. It's a win-win, really. And we're taking people to medical appointments, taking people, banking, to visit their friends and to the senior center. But it's a way for people to get around that have no other way of getting around. And our program is really very successful, so much so that the United Way has seen fit to give us one of only 2 or 3 transportation grants in the county. So we get $5,000 from the United Way, and we've been getting $9,000 from the City of Monroe, which is $14,000. Despite that, it works as a donation. We ask our riders for a $1.50 donation if they can, but we never refuse anybody a ride if they can. So that's another several thousand dollars. But despite that, our bus has 85,000 miles on it now. And last year we had over $2,000 in repairs and fuels increasing and et cetera, et cetera. We were in the hole over $8,000 last year, despite our best efforts. I'm working with the Monroe School District right now to see if we can, and we have an agreement in principle. They our board's approved it, their board just, the school board just has to approve it, or we can do our maintenance right here on Main Street instead of going to Mukilteo. Doing on Main Street, I'd be able to purchase their fuel, so we'd be able to save some money that way. I'm just waiting for that to come to fruition. So pretty much all I have to say, just once again, thank you for, I'll throw a little anecdote out here. I wasn't going to say this, but my peer in Snohomish, at the Snohomish, he went before the Snohomish City Council and asked them for $34,000 to support the senior center. I would never do that. They said, no, you're going to have to be happy with the $12,000 you now get. It's a good number. Monroe's in competition with Snohomish. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. I didn't have anyone else signed up this evening, but is there anyone else who'd like to address council this evening on any subject other than a matter that is subject to a public hearing? No? Okay. Before we do move on, I just want to make note that we do have a guest in the audience this evening, and I won't mention who they are, and I don't want to embarrass them. But we do have a student here who is interested in the student representative role. Councilmember Camp and I met with a student prior to this evening's meeting, and so the student is here to observe, and hopefully they'll return with a desire to serve in that role, and should that be the case, I'll be bringing the student to council in the next couple of weeks for appointment. So, I do not clear enough, but not so clearly.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. With that said, consent agenda this evening, it looks like item number two, and then may I have a motion to approve consent agenda
item? We pull item number one, too.
Okay, I decided. All right, with that, is there a motion?
Motion to approve consent agenda items 3 and 4 only.
Second.
Motion has been made by Councilmember Hamford, seconded by Councilmember Davis to approve consent agenda items 3 and 4. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Councilmember Hamford. Excuse me, Councilmember Hamford.
Thank you. In the minutes, staff reports, mayor council member reports. It wasn't council member Hanford who thanked the mayor's son for his service, it was me. So, correct that. That's all I have.
I appreciate that still. Council member Hanford.
I still appreciate your son. Thank you, that's all.
And I did convey that message. My son was home from Afghanistan visiting last week, but left yesterday back for his post. All right, so with that change,
I move to approve item number one.
Second.
Motion has been made by Councilmember Camp and seconded by Councilmember Hanford to approve item number one with the changes recommended. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Buttons of caution, both Councilmember Gamble and myself will be recusing ourselves from this next action item. We will ask that Mayor Pro Tem would lead the council direct consent agenda item number two.
All right, let the record show that Mayor Zimmerman and Councilmember Gamble have left council chambers, and so at this point I will entertain a motion to approve consent agenda item number two.
So moved.
Second.
Okay, a motion been made by Councilmember Camp, seconded by Councilmember Hanford. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, motion carries 5-6.
Thank you, Councilmember Williams. There was a recommendation by City Administrator Brazel that there be a change in tonight's agenda. I'll bring this before you, Council, and if you're in agreement will proceed in that direction. Large number of individuals here tonight, I believe, are here to hear the presentation with regards to new business item number 3. With that, we would recommend that we move all new business items before unfinished items and begin with item number 3 and then continue through 1, 2, and then into unfinished business. Is there consensus?
Yep.
City Attorney, Will? Okay, we will move to new business item number 3. As they fall.
Thank you. Bringing some new business tonight on the East Monroe Compound Amendment Final Environmental Impact Statement. This is intended to be an introduction to this document. This, which we got by visually about 400 pages. We completed a draft EIS back in August and sent it out for comments. We got almost 200 comments. And this final version responds to each and every comment from individuals, public agencies, and so forth, and sets out the basis for what Susan is going to talk about. I want to introduce two people. I'm not sure if you all have met Melissa Sartorius. She's our senior planner and also our SEPA official, doing a great job. And Susan Boyd with Pace Engineers. Susan is basically the principal author of this work. And she's going to give us give you a presentation, an overview of this EIS tonight. Just a couple things. This EIS, there is no action to be taken with this. This is an exercise of the city and the applicant's consultant. And the city is actually the owner of this document. We issued it. And the intent of this presentation is to give you an overview, give you some information that will help with your consideration of this comp plan amendment, which is going to be coming back to you over the next several weeks. So it informs you as to what it is that is being considered as potential impacts and how they're being addressed. You know, let Susan give you, you know, a good bit more detail. But we're here tonight for our first step in reviewing the East Monroe Amendment of the 3 amendments that we have for this year. East Monroe text amendments for about 3 chapters, and bringing back the school mitigation fees amendment. So we'll be bringing materials bit by bit over the next several meetings with final actions in December. So I'd like to turn over to Susan for a presentation.
Thank you, Paul. Do you know how to fire up the projector? Step one complete. Thank you for the introduction, Paul. My name is Susan Boyd. I'm with Pace Engineers. I'm a vice president with Pace, one of their founding members, and as Paul mentioned, led the team on this final environmental impact statement concerning the rezone of the property that's known as the East Monroe Comp Plan Amendment and Property Rezone. Much better. The final environmental impact statement, as Paul mentioned, was issued on September 27. The document was, The document was prepared by a team of excellent consultants led by Pace Engineers with some real specialists in wetlands by Wetland Resources. Scott Brainerd helped us in that capacity, and Gibson Traffic Consultants assisted with the traffic analysis, and geoengineers assisted us with the soils and some of the earthwork analyses in the EIS. The EIS process has been an accelerated one, but nevertheless, it's getting lengthy. We issued a draft EIS back in August of this year. We introduced it to the Planning Commission later in August, beginning of September, had a public hearing on the document itself, on the draft EIS. The purpose of the draft is to generate public comment and to get people talking, and talk they did. We got quite a few comments, as Paul mentioned, during the 30-day comment period that ended the middle of September. Excuse me. With, again, the final EIS issued, says 9/26. I believe it was actually 9/27 was the official date in the CEPA register. Going back to the beginning, the proposed action that was addressed in the EIS process was a comprehensive plan amendment, property rezone, to take a look at the property that's shown on the right-hand side of the screen there and consider it for rezone from limited open space to general commercial. Many of you probably recall that in 2012 there was a similar proposal brought forth. The proposal of the 2012 EIS is shown on the left. That was about 68 acres of property. You might notice that parcel F is missing from the right-hand side, taking about 20 acres off of the proposal. The property that was addressed in this EIS is all under one ownership, five parcels, again, almost 43 acres. Excuse me, I'm kind of coming down with something here, right before your eyes. The 2013 FEIS is a new and expanded analysis based on the 2012 EIS that was prepared. Again, we reduced the project area. We looked at public comment and hearing examiner comments to the previous EIS, identified what was short, what the shortcomings were there, addressed those in this year's EIS to make sure that we were compliant with current code and regulation, following best available science, and accepted engineering processes and practices. Additional detail was provided to really look deeply at the rezone action. We looked at likely impacts associated with potential development in addition to just the rezone itself. I got to get my drink to be right back. Sorry. Mr. Pratt, though. We can go a little smoother for us here. Excuse me again. We looked at not just the rezone action, but the likely impacts of a rezone if the property were to develop. We expanded and looked at a comparative analysis of three alternatives, looked especially at critical areas, traffic, and cumulative impacts. We looked at three development scenarios, a no-action alternative, the proposed action, which was a rezone to general commercial and rezone to mixed-use commercial. And we looked closely at on-site constraints and limitations, including streams, wetlands, shorelines, native growth protection areas, steep slopes, and floodplains. I'm really sorry. All those constraints are shown on the critical areas map that you see in front of you. Nothing really new here that people familiar with the property aren't aware of. There's steep slopes along the whole northern side. There's native growth protection area sort of through the middle, leading us with a developable area in the orange area that's shown. The developable area there again is shown as that orange area. Off-site constraints and limitations we looked at, again, traffic, aesthetics, impacts, noise, public utilities and services, and the cumulative impacts. The impacts of mitigation are sort of summarized on this slide. Topography and soils was a biggie that we looked at. The steep slopes on the northern side of the property and needing to be preserved in their natural state. Cut and fill to accommodate floodplain and flood storage on the property. In other words, we need to make sure that there's the same amount of flood storage available in the future that there is today. That was accomplished in accordance with national standards. We looked at wetlands and shorelines, identified areas that needed to be protected, aesthetics, noise, light, glare, traffic, transportation, public services, all required features of an EIS. Those are the types of things, though, that get looked at a little closer when there's an actual development proposal, which we don't have this time. It's just a proposal for a rezone. So, although they're addressed, they do defer to future analysis at the time of a development proposal,
I just want to emphasize there that this is your first look at SEPA. When you do an EIS for a rezone or a non-project action, you look at these things more globally, and you drill down when you get an actual development proposal later. So, sorry, again. One of the big things that was discussed throughout the process was how do we make sure that the flood elevation is maintained and not not creating more of a flood hazard? How do we protect the critical areas? How do we develop the site? This summary is really key to what we looked at as a reasonable solution for mitigation on the property in compliance with all the various codes and regulations that there are. You'll notice there's a red line, a 100-year flood elevation across the entire drawing there. I want to emphasize that a lot of the comments we received were in concern with the flood elevation. Any development on the property would have to be such that that flood elevation wouldn't change. The steep slope that I discussed earlier is located, or is shown on the left-hand side there. Even with development, that flood elevation would not go any higher up the slope, is what I'm trying to convey. The planting plans and whatnot that are shown there are intended to show planting initially when the project's developed, and then what they would reach at a maturity date to sort of screen the property from the hillside above the neighboring property owners and protect the sensitive areas. The DEIS, as Paul mentioned, received a lot of comments. There were 19 people commenting, 15 individuals, 4 agencies. The individuals, their comments were a lot related to what's going to happen in my backyard, more questions on is this compliant with codes, how would the development occur, whether or not the no action alternative had been appropriately addressed, things like that. The agencies were all pretty supportive of the proposal, indicating that further analysis would be required later. They would want to look at the proposal as development proposals were made in the future. Ecology commented and actually came out to the property a little later in the process and concurred with our findings and analysis on the property. So that's a summary of some of the comments. And here's a summary of some of the changes that were made as a result of the comments, basically clarifications. I'll give you a minute to take a look at those and see if there's any questions. In summary, I think we just clarified what was already in the document, brought things further to the front. Let's see, my voice a little bit. You can come back if you have questions on them. I think it's important to point out in summary that that the findings and opportunities that we thought were important is that the property is within the urban growth area. As such, an urban level of development is appropriate. A balance between environmental protection, community development, and commercial activity is achievable. The current condition of the site, the shorelines and wetlands, is poor. Potential habitat deterioration without corrective action is very apparent to us and the scientists that have participated with this. Current code provides a lot of opportunity for the property owners and future developers to help improve the site, to enhance the wetlands, to enhance the streams, to increase opportunities for habitat for fish and animals, as well as provide opportunities for flood management that I think the whole valley will appreciate. I think that the proposal provides an opportunity for coordinated land use and transportation improvements. WSDOT didn't really say a lot about this proposal in their comment letter, other than to acknowledge that, yes, access would need to be provided to the site off of SR2. SR2 is a tricky road. They asked us to come back and do an analysis of the potential of a roundabout. We did that in the final EIS. And one of the big comments that I probably should have mentioned a little earlier from the public was, wow, this could be an expensive piece of property to develop. How would it be paid for? How would it be financed? Just like any other development in the city, it'd be funded by the property owners. That includes extension of utilities, mitigation, as well as development costs and any impact fees that the city would charge any other property. So,
Susan, may I interrupt real quick? Just a couple of items
to
come in before you continue. Councilmember Camp, do you have a question?
Thank you, I did. Sorry about your voice, but can you explain a little bit about the current condition of shoreline and wetland areas?
Basically, we have the... Actually, back up. Maybe my voice is calming down a little bit for me here. Basically, in this, the blue striped area is sort of the native growth protection area for the site. And there's a stream that goes through, it's sort of a horseshoe, as most people aware of the site know. Along that stream, the north side is a steep hillside that has nice vegetation, existing vegetation that's keeping the hillside in place and doing very well. The south side of the stream, not so much. The wetlands are degrading. Invasive species are taking over and sort of choking out that stream. And the habitat quality is quite poor there, according to the wetlands biologists that did their analysis. So when we looked at some options for mitigation and what a developer might do in the future, we saw some real opportunities to both improve the health of the stream and make the site more environmentally sound, if you will, going forward.
So are impacts, the stream would eventually dry up?
I don't think it would actually dry up, but the opportunities for fish to live in it, to get through from the river into the stream, or other habitat, other animals to want to be in that stream, would certainly degrade. It's really invasive blackberries and whatnot that just sort of choke off the stream.
All right, thank you.
Other questions or? I feel a little bad now. I have my voice. I can start over again, but you probably heard enough. The only other thing that I think I really had wanted to mention that I sort of could have done a little bit better on was that that we did look at these three scenarios. The no action alternative, though, I want to be very clear that the EIS and the letter of the law, I guess, through CEPA regulations, is that we look at no action. This is a non-project proposal, so no action in this case is to retain the limited open space zoning and allow for development, you know, what development could occur there at this point under this zoning. And that's what we looked at initially in the draft EIS. The final EIS, we went back and we added some clarifications on the range of activities that might be feasible there. So we just really wanted to dot all our I's, if you will, and address the public concerns.
Councilmember Hamper, you had a question for Paul?
Yeah, just clarifying, Paul. One of the things you had said earlier tonight was that we're the owners of this EIS. But my understanding is that the city didn't pay for the EIS.
That's correct. And when I made that statement, what I mean is that the city worked with Pace on preparing this EIS, and the city, as the responsible agency, issues the EIS, and we take ownership of that document, that we endorse the document, that it is good science, and it's complete. That's what I meant by that statement.
I just want to clarify for the public.
Right. All the costs were borne by the applicant.
Okay. Thank you.
If you don't mind, Paul, if I might clarify as well, is that this is the action taken by staff is no different than what you might do for other applications in terms of working with applicants, working with individuals looking to develop or take on a project within the city, so you worked with them, but the EIS itself, all of those people that were listed on there, those folks were paid for by, not by the city, but by somebody else.
That's correct. And you can consider it almost like a subdivision application where the city works with the applicant all the way through the process to reach the final action, and in the case of a subdivision, approval by staff. And it's the same path with this, as the EIS being the final product that had to be worked until it was approved by staff, in this case specifically by Melissa or SEPA official. But the city is the responsible agency for this.
Councilmember Bailey?
Got me before I even passed it. Look at that. I had a couple questions just for clarification. Just to make sure I understand what is allowed under Alternative 1 under the no action for the LOS. On page 9, if the EIS, it talks about one dwelling per 5 acres. Does that include residential, or could that be a
yes.
home?
Yes, it certainly could.
Okay.
It certainly could.
When I looked on page 18 under the chart and listed under alternative 1, it said building and then residential. It had a dash. So
we did not consider residential zoning as part of the no action alternative. Under no action, we had to pick a scenario. And under the no action, we looked at a church, daycare, and a gym facility.
But residential is allowed under
it. Residential is allowed under it now. And one of the reasons we chose the church is because that had been proposed on the site before and had moved through. So that's. We did, however, look at some residential activity under Alternative 3. We thought, well, you know, what would happen if we did a true mixed-use development here? What would the impacts be? And so those are identified. And although they weren't a lot different from Alternative 2, some of the traffic impacts are different. Didn't really want to close that door.
But you picked that scenario, but currently under the current zoning of limited open space residential is allowed one dwelling per 5 acres.
Yes.
That's correct.
Okay. Just wanted to clarify that. And then on page 29, talking about compensatory storage, yep. That's a difficult, you know, it's complicated. So do you mind just kind of walking me through, because to me that
it is
that deals with the floodplain, and I'm trying to figure out how elevating, you know, putting in fill and raising it up, I think what was the 68 or
thank you
but putting in fill and raising it up,
yes,
how do you get enough compensatory storage on
to make it happen. Right. And so the first concept to understand is that we kind of took this property to an extreme in terms of we wanted to look at a worst case under the alternatives 2 and 3 especially. And so we figured, okay, if we wanted to develop as much as we possibly could, how much compensatory storage would we need? If a smaller development proposal were taken, the compensatory storage issue would become smaller.
Sure.
I just want to be clear about that. If you look again at this kind of confusing at first, but really informative drawing in the long run, again, here's your 100-year flood elevation right here, this red line. We need to bring the property at least a foot above that level to put a building on it safely. And so to do that, we looked at, okay, see, this is the existing grade right here. We'd have to fill it up to this elevation 68. So we've just eliminated that little shaded area of area where flood water could sit,
right.
Basically.
Where does it go?
So what we did is we excavated it out from here. And so along the stream, our thinking here is, and this is the stream right here, our thinking was, if we could consolidate the lower elevations along the stream, we could keep water moving through the stream more effectively, plant better vegetation there, and keep the flood water here where it could drain off quicker rather than having an inch over the whole site. It might be a little deeper right next to the stream in this area. We don't propose any touching over here as we go up to the properties to the north. So this, these little bumps right here get excavated out. They make the flood storage for these areas that are... The National Flood Protection NFIP, National Flood Insurance Protection Group, if you will, they have a code. It's 44 CFR 60.3, if you care. But it explains how this has to happen, how it's done everywhere in the country. It's a very common method of flood management. And flood management is one of the few things you can and should do in a critical area buffer. I was pretty pleased that the tribes weighed in on the EIS and sort of supported that same notion. So one thing that they did note and that we did clarify in the final EIS is that when we talk about excavation in this area, we're not talking about excavating within the actual stream boundaries, only in buffers.
Okay.
That was another comment that we received. So. Does that help, I hope?
Slightly.
Slightly.
I'll wrestle with it.
Okay.
That's it for now.
Any other questions? Paul, I've heard through the grapevine that currently somebody could build a cement factory out there if they wanted to. Is that true?
Before my time. Yes, a cement plant or cement manufacturing isn't allowed use in the limited open space in our current zoning code.
So no action is ever taken out there. Somebody could build a cement factory.
It's possible, yes.
I just had heard that, so I thought I might want to clear it up.
Yes, that's something that will definitely change as we work through the code. I might just offer a little bit of information about process. Since this final EIS was issued, we've been in an appeal period. The draft EIS is not an appealable, was not an appealable document. This is. It's our appeal period ends this Friday, October 18th at 5 o'clock. And we are likely to receive an appeal of this FEIS, which would be taken to the hearing examiner, much like it was last year. That hearing examiner will make a decision, and if the appeal is found to be lacking, there is a period after that of reconsideration, but then we move to final action and in December. And we don't want to take that action until the hearing examiner decision has been made, but in December, after council takes final action, that will trigger on December 23rd, the start of a 60-day appeal period, which would be an appeal of the comp plan amendment, not just the FEIS, but the East Monroe amendment in this case, to the state hearings board. That comes due by February 21st, something like that. So there will be a two-month period where an appeal may come back on the entire action. The council is required to take final action after the hearing examiner before any other appeal can be filed. So that's basically the steps we have ahead of us. I think I got that right, didn't I?
That's correct, Paul.
Great.
The NECPA appeal arising out of the hearing examiner's decision will be applicable to the roadmap report in the same manner and in the same time frame as the council's action on the ordinance itself.
Thank you. Well, I just have two. Well, one is a question, one might be a comment. It listed a couple times in this EIS, it states that the respond to our demand for lack of undeveloped commercial property along SR2 is one of the reasons for proposing this. And it's mentioned three or four times in the beginning of the document. Is there any evidence that substantiates that claim that there's a demand for property currently on SR2?
The original notion from that comes with with property owners and feel, you know, and experiencing an increased need for developable property.
Property owners of this property?
Yes. And I believe that the city has some analyses that...
we have done inventory of vacant commercial and vacant industrial ground in the city. I don't recall the exact numbers, but and within city limits for commercial ground, there really is no ground available on SR2. Most of what we have is in the North Kelsey area. I'm thinking, I don't want to throw out fair because I don't recall the exact numbers, but that's where probably two-thirds of our available commercial ground is now. It includes the landfill site and the remaining parcels to be sold in North Kelsey. We have quite a bit of ground, maybe 15, 20 acres, that's scattered all through the city in the mixed-use zones and the service commercial zones. So we have that should surprise me, I thought we had more land available, but a fairly finite supply of commercial ground. And the same is actually true with industrial ground. We have a finite amount of vacant industrial ground. We have some empty space, built space, but not very much in the way of open ground for new construction.
So the property on Highway 2 in Frylands that's been for sale, what is that?
That's the block plant?
Yeah.
I believe that's service commercial. We count that as commercial ground.
Commercial ground,
right.
Yeah.
And that would be an exception to SRF 2 frontage. That's right.
Right. And the airport, what's that zone?
That's a zoned limited open space airport, which does basically allow, as we call, airport-related uses and some non-airport-related uses that would be supportive of that operation. Could be things like those schools, maybe a hotel, that sort of thing, but there is that fairly large area there with some airport restrictions.
Okay. And then just a question about the schedule, because looking at the schedule of the review schedule, there's a meeting scheduled for, I believe it's Veterans Day, which is a state and federal holiday for the Planning Commission. Is that typical that we have a Planning Commission meeting reviewing documents on a holiday?
Not typical, no.
Is there a rationale for doing that schedule that way?
Well, we wanted to have we originally planned the public hearing to be held a little bit earlier, but we're still working with the Commission through these other couple of amendments, and we didn't feel we were going to be ready to bring it to the public hearing stage. And November 11th was the next best available date to allow the Commission time to consider it and form a recommendation before the end of November for Council. And we're going to be bringing it back for your review in the interim as well, but the Commission recommendation falls on like November 25th, and basically we're starting to run out of calendar.
Yeah, so I guess my question is there a reason why this, you know, it has to be decided December 17th before the close of this year? Is there a reason why it can't be decided in the beginning of January?
We are basically obligated or mandated to adopt within the calendar year for the 2013 amendments, and the East Monroe has come along as a continuation, you know, of a former amendment. But Zach, do you have any... Would you like to add something to that? I think that there is a possible to defer.
Council, to answer the question, there is a possibility for council to take action on part of this year's docket in the calendar year following, as long as the amendments are considered concurrently and as our cumulative impacts are considered concurrently by the council. Growth Management Hearing Board's rules and the GMA interpretive regulations do provide for action to be taken during the subsequent year, if that's your preference. It's certainly contemplated and it's preferable from a policy standpoint to act concurrently on all amendments and yeah, but there is a legal mechanism to allow action in the subsequent year.
Thank you. Thank you, Councilmember Cotabac. Anybody else?
Just a very brief clarification, Council, in case I made a misstatement earlier. The 60-day deadline for appealing the City Council's decision on the ordinance is actually triggered by publication of that ordinance, not by your action in adopting it.
That's the December 23rd date that I mentioned. But it could be the scheduled publication date.
All right, I don't see any other lights. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
No actions.
Thank you.
Taken this evening.
Thank you.
I appreciate the presentation and information.
Thank you very much. And again, apologies for the voice.
That's right. I think I've got it now.
Yeah, stay away from the microphone.
Paul, excuse me. Let me grab those lights real quick. Thank you. Moving on to new business item number one, presentation of general fund and internal services funds budget. And
I fall down this real quick.
Oh, yes.
Just kidding.
Yep, let me move it again.
Don't get comfy, right?
Yeah.
Okay, tonight is the first of two budget presentations. Tonight we'll be talking about the general fund, the governmental funds, and the internal service fund. So basically, tonight we're talking about operations and not capital or utilities. And so that'll be the theme for tonight's presentation. The general governmental funds and the internal service funds, on the left are all the governmental funds, our operating funds. We have our general fund, contingency fund, which was created about a year or two ago, donation fund, 800 megahertz equipment fund, street maintenance fund. That is not the street capital fund, that's the street maintenance. Transportation fees fund, that's a transportation concurrency fund. Tourism fund, which is the hotel lodging tax fund. The narcotic fund for drug activity of the police department for arresting people. Activity, and then the real estate excise tax fund, known as the REIT fund. The three internal service funds are our IT fund, fleet and equipment, and facilities management. The general fund covers all of our operations except for street maintenance and utilities. It's usually the main focus of the budget. That's where everyone looks and wants to see what's going on. And it's generally supported by tax dollars. Those first two slides I lifted off of last year's presentation. The general fund budget, we're expecting $11 million in revenues. Operating expenditures are budgeted at $11.3 million. And one-time project expenditures are at $1.3 million. I know your first question is, how come expenditures are more than revenues? And the reason is, it's about $275,000 more, and about $75,000 of it is we're using fund balance to start the new court, municipal court. There's a slide later on talking about that. And then the other $200,000 is we budget conservatively. We basically know that revenues are going to come in at least $100,000 more than what we budgeted, and expenditures are going to be at least $100,000 less than what we budgeted. So, I'm not, when it gets within $200,000 of each other, you're talking about 1% differential. So, I'm not concerned about getting that. Any more than that, we would probably want to start cutting, but at this point, it's pretty basically even. Fund balance makes up the difference just to balance the budget, but I don't think and see us having to use fund balance for it. The general fund revenues, where the money comes from. We are basically a sales tax city, as you can see. Utility tax and property tax are our other two big tax sources. And so that's pretty much where we get all of our money. Charges for services, that's some of the developmental items such as permit fees and things like that, and development, you know, construction type fees for planning and permitting and building department. And the financial and legal and administrative services that are charged to the other funds for their services. So looking at the three main revenues, property tax revenue, it's estimated to be $1.9 million for 2014. The preliminary budget does not make use of the 1% levy increase that we're allowed by law. I've learned my lesson that this council does not want to raise taxes, and the mayor does not, and so this year I didn't even ask for it. And the total levy increase is $24,000, and that's strictly due to new construction coming on our assessment rolls, our tax rolls. And so, and that's taxed at the previous year's rate, not at the current year's rate. Sales tax revenue, total sales tax revenue is estimated to be at $3.8 million. Sales taxes are baby. Of that $2,863,000 comes from that voted increase that the public voted in for public safety. $245,000 is what we get from the county. It's a sales tax levy that they do for criminal justice. And we get $245,000 of it, and that goes strictly to public safety as well. And then $3.3 million for the rest of general operations. That general operations, $3.3 million, that's an increase of $369,000 from last year. And what we're estimating that increase to be from is we're going to get a huge amount of sales tax from just the construction of the Walmart facility. And then once they're open, we'll be getting additional sales tax. And plus, we are emerging from the recession. People are starting to spend money again, and we're seeing that steadily. So we're expecting, that's why that amount is about $369,000 more than last year's. Utility tax revenues, in the budget, it's estimated to be $2 million. And that's an 8% increase over what we had for last year's budget. And the reason it's increased by 8% is there's new homes being built in the city that are going to be occupied. And so that means when people change their address, your utility taxes go where your address is. So that's more residents in our city. And also the taxes on the utilities' gross revenues. So when other utilities raise their rates, the tax amount that we get increases as well. Planning and building fees. You can see, for comparison purposes, I put up the budget for this current year, the estimate for this year, what we think it's going to actually come in at the end of the year, and then what's budgeted for 2014, because I wanted to show you that you can see it came in strong in 2013, and this is a real volatile revenue stream. When it comes in good, it's really good, but it can also go away real fast too, like when we had, you know, the recession. So it goes up and down with construction trends. So that's why we are budgeting conservatively with these fees. So instead of just jumping off of where we think 2013 is going to end, we're like, no, let's be conservative. And Paul and Gene and Brad, they all sat down and thought long and hard about what projects they thought were going to come in when, you know. But again, you're trying to guess what a developer is going to do. What they say they'll do and what they actually do are not always the same thing. So moving on to the general fund expenditures, public safety is the largest portion of the pie. Public safety includes, it's the big chunk of it is the police department, but it also includes what we pay for jail, dispatch, the new municipal court, and emergency management. And you can see the parks and recreation take up about 11%, planning, permitting, building 10%, finance 4%, admin, legal about 9%. And I don't know what else to say about that. It's pretty standard, those percentages. New this year in the general fund is the municipal court. It will be designated as a department in the general fund, just like planning or building or something. And it will have one full-time employee, court administrator, that they are planning on hiring in July. So we've only budgeted for half a year's salary in the preliminary budget. The initial year costs are expected to be $73,000, and that money's all coming from money that we received from photo enforcement that's set aside, and so in fund balance, so we're using fund balance money to pay for the initial cost of this. We're expecting it to, our hope is that it'll be eventually pretty revenue neutral or cost neutral, because we will no longer be paying Evergreen District Court for services that we'll be doing here, and we will also get the ticket revenue rather than giving the ticket revenue to the district court. Community projects.
Thank you.
Do you mind if I ask a question before we move on?
Yeah.
So just to make sure, so we're talking about revenue, but you were talking about expense right there. It's going to cost $73 for the year.
Uh huh.
Do you have a projected revenue stream of what that court would bring in?
For 2014, we're saying zero.
You're saying zero.
Yeah.
Okay.
Doesn't go into effect until 2015.
The court itself won't go into effect until, okay. So you're just kind of ramping up in 2014, getting it ready, and then in 2015 it'll take over.
Correct.
I mean, it'll go into effect, and that's when we'd see a revenue stream. Okay. And when you said it was funded from the photo enforcement revenues,
mm-hmm.
it was my understanding that, so are you talking about the cameras?
Red light cameras, yeah.
Okay,
in school zones.
Did that revenue this year, it's my understanding, go directly into the general fund, into the police budget? Or
we put it into a restricted fund balance for public safety purposes.
Okay, that you can carry over to next year and use some of that fund?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And that's where it's coming from. We're taking it out.
How much is in that fund currently, in that restricted fund
I'm
balance?
Not exactly sure currently. At the end of the year of 2014, there will be about $200,000.
Okay.
So $273,000, then, I guess.
Okay, and that's in a restricted to be used for public safety
only.
And then 73 of that are for to fund this is coming from there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Thanks.
Community projects, $10,000 to the Senior Center Transportation Program. That project has been funded at the level of $9,000 per year since 2008. We've not increased it. And so in this preliminary budget, we put it up to 10. It's council's discretion if you want to put it up to 12, as Mark was asking. He originally was going to come in and ask for, he didn't know about the $10,000, and he was going to ask for 12. And then when he talked and found out that it was $10,000, he said he felt like it would be greedy to ask for 12 because here you're giving him more, and he's going, but wait, I want more, you know. So I just wanted you to know that his original intent was to ask for 12, but because we had bumped it up to 10, he felt bad about asking. $20,000 is for the downtown signage and wayfinding, and then $10,000 for a GIS intern mapping project, and that's part of economic development. Jeff, do you want to talk a little bit about that, or sorry to put you on the spot?
Oh, no sweat. We have two folks in city.
Give me a second real quick. A question, stepping back real quick, Councilmember Gamble.
Yes, yeah. on the senior center.
Yeah.
Maybe would the council be willing to support something more than the, you know, the 10? I'd kind of like to see some. If he brought up the comparison, I will, but I mean in all seriousness and beyond my competitive nature. you know, that is a definite need, and we have more and more, you know, people, one of the largest we've ever had ongoing, you know, retiring, becoming seniors, and the lack of transportation, not being able to or have that connection to the world. This is a great program. And you know, any support that we can, you know, provide, you know, to that, if we have the means, I personally think that we should be working to try to fund that to the best of our ability.
And I appreciate that. I'm in absolute agreement. I am a little bit competitive in that way. Certainly with my leader at this college. And I'd hope to increase it anyway. The fact that he was going to ask for more, I don't think that's greedy. There's some, you know, some great credit needs, gas prices. The things that were mentioned already, that he mentioned, are very real. And the service that it does provide is outstanding. It's very vital. I've actually been thinking a little bit more than that, but if the rest of council agrees, it's certainly something to talk about. I did have another question aside, but I do appreciate you yielding. Thank you.
So,
why don't you take, just continue with the floor?
All right, Councilmember.
Thank you, Mayor. And thank you, Councilmember. Then I did just a quick question about where exactly this money was coming from at the senior center. And you had on page 12, because I looked through the preliminary budget, I didn't see it specifically called out, but I think that you mentioned it was on page 12 under services and charges.
Yes.
That's a much larger number than just 10,000. So there's some other things that are included there as well, and you might maybe let me know what some of the other items are.
That $344,000 under services and charges under the admin department, $12,000 of it is to codify the Monroe Municipal Code. The fees for that, $80,000 is our liability insurance, $30,000 is the City Hall phone systems, our monthly bills for like cell phones and things like that. The interfund charges that the city pays to the internal service funds are in there. $50,000 goes to the IT fund, $50,000 goes to the fleet and equipment fund, $70,000 goes to the facility maintenance fund, the $10,000 for the seniors. But there's also things like postage and other professional services.
But so it's lumped in. This is lumped in with something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Great, appreciate that.
Sure.
And we can agree with Councilor Gamble with it as far as certainly willing to entertain. And I do appreciate the effort for it.
Do you guys want to come to a consensus on a number now, or do you want to wait till later? Or?
Yeah, we've got a couple items we'd like to answer. I think a little background, and I don't know that you have the answer, Brad. You've got numbers out of your mind forever, so you probably would have the best recollection. You and the city administrator, Bradwell, but I think at one time the city had supported the senior center with $15,000 years ago, is something that I recall. And then we lowered it because of the economy that, you remember, do you recall?
Kind of sounds vaguely familiar, but don't recall it off the top of my head.
Yeah, first time. All right. Okay. Well, I was trying to get some background, because I know that the support was higher at one time. The economy had caused us to lower that support. I just don't remember what the number was exactly, but with that, Councilmember King.
Thank you. I think you're going down the same road, Mark. I'm not quite as competitive as my competitors up here, but if Mr. Abney was planning on asking for $12,000, I assume that he would have some kind of back documentation for it. So before we come to a consensus to kick up $12,000, I'd like to see something from him just explaining. They provide a benefit. I just want something on paper just describing what that benefit is so we can agree to it.
Sure.
I'm not against it. I'm not even against the $12,001 I heard at the other end of the council.
Thank you, Councilor Wade.
Thank you. You know, this is a topic that's been popular with everybody on council. We've been funding at a fairly low level ever since I've been here. We're kind of coming out of it. We're a little in much better financial shape than we used to be. I'd like to see the number go up. I agree with Councilmember Gamble, and I don't see any reason why we wouldn't be able to beat Snohomish. We did on Friday. So, and I also like kind of even, you know, numbers in, you know, 13,000, I don't like that. So I would support 15. To Councilmember Camp's point, the director's been in here many times over the last several years. They run that place on a very tight, tight budget, and they do a lot of good in the community, and it's definitely an area, it's a demographic that we're all heading towards, some faster than others. So at any rate, if we're looking for consensus, I'd like to, I would support 15. You know, I think it's time to step up. It represents such a small increase. I mean, the difference of that from what we're doing now is such an insignificant portion of our overall budget. I think it makes sense.
I'm done. I agree, but the impact is big to the recipient.
Correct.
And that's what I think. Yeah, I could not agree more.
Councilmember Hamm.
I have an agreement with the $15.
Okay, I'll correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm going to, for the final budget when it comes to you, I'm going to change this $10,000 to $15,000. And also, in the meantime, I will get from Mark a breakdown of their program.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. He's brought it in the past.
Yeah. I've to write it down.
With that, sorry to interrupt, Jeff, you were going to explain just a little bit about the GIS Interim Mapping Project and its significance to economic development.
So what I'm trying to achieve is we have two qualified GIS folks in City Hall, one in Public Works, one in Planning. They both have different jobs. And what I would like to do is just pull together the data set that we could put into the GIS layers that would talk about business licenses, property owners, leases, revenue generated from property taxes, estimates on sales tax revenue from areas, layer the zonings in, and start to build a GIS system that we can start to analyze where the business is in town, where the community is, and start to look at that. We would be appealing to the higher education, either at their community college or UW, into their computer labs. Apparently, the students are very anxious to get this type of real-world experience, and the $10,000 in discussions would basically cover a quality workstation for the individual and a small per diem to help with transportation, that sort of thing, perhaps a minimum wage type effort to get the student to Monroe to work with us. So that's the idea behind it, and I've been wanting to do this for a couple of years, and it just it's one of those things where the job that our two GIS experts do most of the time is far more important than all of this package together.
That's
very good.
Thank you. I had a question about the downtown signage and wayfinding sign, just to go back to that one. I remember we had a business owner from the Frylands Industrial Park come in, Clearview Spirits, and requested looking at wayfinding in that area also, and we had said that we would look at that. Is that included in this $20,000? Have we looked at adding in wayfinding on that side of town besides downtown?
So the intent with this package of money would be to hire a consultant to come in and work with the community as a whole to find out, first of all, what are we trying to find in town? And then what are those signs going to look like aesthetically to guide people into town? And then out of that, we would end up with design standards, so we would end up with a color palette, a light color, a post standard, a sign size standard, all the things that we would need to purchase and place signage throughout the city to guide people to the places we want them to go, whether it's historic downtown or the industrial park or the North Kelsey area, the library, City Hall. And what we would then have is a consistent package of let's call them design standards for these sign elements, so that when a business owner perhaps wants to guide to their business, and that's going to be a policy question, we want to allow them to purchase, you know, the pre-designed signage to get to their business. And that's going to be a policy question that is not part of this package, but what we're going to end up with is that architecturally designed package.
So that is more $20,000 for a consultant to look at wayfinding in general throughout the city.
Correct.
Defining standards, possibly. Was there work done in the downtown master plan? I remember a section on wayfinding signs in the downtown master plan. Would we look back at that and look, is that still relevant? I don't know. I can't remember off the top of my head how much detail as far as, but there were concepts and there was a discussion around wayfinding in that plan.
This is the fruition of that request. Downtown master plan, and as well as the branding plan, the tourism plan, highly recommend that
sure.
we do this for the city. So it was never done in part of those plans. It was alluded to that we need to do this next step.
Okay. Okay. Thank you, Jeff.
Okay. And out of the general fund, the capital projects and transfers are $350 for the non-transportation elements of the comp plan. $109,000 is being transferred to the sick leave reserve per the reserve policy. It said we would transfer 10% of general fund revenues every year until our entire liability is met. And then $850,000 is being transferred to the North Kelsey Development Fund, and that's for the filling in of the pond to create buildable land. Is I think council discussed this at a previous council meetings. And that's it for big money thing on the general fund. Personnel changes in the 2014 preliminary budget are 5 new FTEs. There's the 2 police officers that are funded from the sales tax voted increase. 1 park maintenance worker during the times of cutting back. Parks lost 3 workers. Well, even before that, they had lost 1 more, too. So, total, they've lost 4. And so they're just asking for 1 back. And planning department has a new position. And that's for all the new development we're starting to see. They're kind of slammed. And then there's the new municipal court administrator that'll come on board for the second half of the year. Wage increases in this preliminary budget are 1.4% for the Teamster Union employees, that's per contract agreement, 4.9% for the police guild, per the contract, and which is tied to sales tax, that 4.9% is, and $121,000 is set aside for the non-represented employees' incentive pay, and that includes benefits as well. But that's just set aside. That's not necessarily, I mean, that's the most they would use. They may not use it all. Since it's merit-based.
I just comment on that one. That's in direct correlation, correct, to the new, the way that we're looking at it from a new review policy where we set aside just more clarification. So that's, it's a bucket of money like we talked about, and basically the logic or the math that Ben did behind that was to apply, you know, if you average it out, you know, 4% to the total salaries, you know, to get what we're planning for the budget. Doesn't mean that all of that has to be used, will be used, or based on performance, but it would be, you know, budgeted. And then we will be, you know, looking at again that policy or the finalized piece of that because we approved the, you know, the interim. And when that comes back, there also will be, you know, kind of the logic, you know, behind the, you know, the 4%, and also some historical numbers to take a look at, you know, what we've done pre, you know, during the lean years, and what we did pre, you know, then from a budgeting perspective, what we actually spend in dollars for incentive pay. That's the first recommendation, you know, recommendation based off the 4%, which is in line.
Yeah. We don't like to say 4% because some people are not going to get a raise.
That's correct. But as far as, yeah. You know, the first question you always get is, you know, what? Why? How did you come up with that number? that's, you know, that's how we came up with the number. And yeah, it's going to depend on performance.
Councilmember Kennedy.
Thank you. So it's based on performance, based on merit, and it's after a performance review or appraisal is completed, and we had just done some this fall, and then there was an adjustment that doesn't carry over till next year, correct? It's a one-time adjustment for that year that isn't cumulative. It doesn't change your salary for the next year. You go back. And so when are these merit? This doesn't start right in January, correct? These merit increases are done in look at reviews every once a year, I would assume, merit increase. So that, I'm trying to get a sense of timing. We budgeted $121,000. Would it all happen again next year at October time frame, September?
Correct. Existing, I won't get into it too in depth because we're going to talk about it next week.
Okay.
But it does sunset. The people that received incentive pay will see the last incentive pay happen on their January paycheck, which is for December's work.
Sure.
And then we'll be doing a review in December every year and then a mid-year review as well. So that's how that'll operate. But that'll
so
be
will this merit increase happen after the mid-year review, or that it should only happen once a year?
It will happen after the December review.
Okay, so at the end of 2014, we project the ending fund balance to be a total of $2.2 million, which is a good number. $200,000 is restricted for public safety. That's left over from the red light camera. There's also about maybe $1,200 from the chicken bust. That money's restricted. That's included in there, but it's a small amount. What was it back in the chicken fighting? That they
fighting.
That's included in that too. There's also the 1.9 restricted for emergencies, and that's per 17% of the general fund expenditures per the reserve policy. And that leaves you with $125,000 of undesignated ending fund balance, and I kind of wouldn't want to go any lower than that. I mean, sure, we'll take, $5,000 or so from that for the senior center, but I wouldn't want to get too much lower. You always like to give yourself some cushion. And even though we have the restricted, I still like to err on the side of caution. But anyway, so that leaves us in pretty nice shape at the end of 2014. That's a good place to be. It's not too much. It's not like we're hoarding tax dollars, but it's conservative. So that was it for the general fund. The contingency fund contains the only expenditure is a one-time transfer, the final $250,000 transfer to the general fund. Back when the theater was first being sold and the next core property was being sold, when council did that resolution of how you wanted to spend the money, there was $750,000 set aside in the contingency fund, and council directed that $250,000 a year for 3 years would be transferred to the general fund to help us through this recession. This is the final transfer. After this, the general fund's on its own. And so then there's also $267,000 of undesignated fund balance in the contingency fund, as well as $900,000 restricted per the reserve policy. So that leaves you with, you add those two numbers together, that's that $1.175 million total ending fund balance, and that's after the transfer to the general fund is made. So contingency fund, that's a nice backup that the city's got. You know, if all hell breaks loose, that will buy us some time. So I think we should feel good about where we sit. Street fund, this is for, again, like I said, for street operations, not, it does, maintenance and, potholes and asphalt overlay, but as far as building new streets, the big major projects, they are not included in this fund. They're in the street capital improvement fund, which we'll talk about next Tuesday. The revenues for the street fund are solid waste franchise fees and gas tax revenues, which are based on population, not on how much gas you buy or sell or use or whatever. The operating expenditures for the street fund are $283,000 more than revenues. And like we've been doing in last few years, well, quite a few years, we're using fund balance in this fund to make up the difference. So this is the big thing that we need to look at in 2014. Going forward, the street fund will completely use up its fund balance at the end of 2014. And future years are going to require a transfer from the general fund to support street maintenance. A lot of cities dedicate a portion of their general fund revenues to street maintenance. And the reason street is in a separate fund is because of the gas tax legislation. We have to keep it in a separate fund. And normally it would just be a department in the general fund. But because of that state legislation, it's a separate fund. And so most cities will siphon off a percentage of their revenue to the street fund. Just right off the top. Future years will require us to do either a transfer to the support the street fund from the general fund. Annual street maintenance overlay costs, if fully funded, would be greater than $1 million a year. And that's huge. More than likely what we are going to try to afford is $250,000 to $500,000 per year. This is going to be an internal battle, I'm sure, with Brad and the other departments of, you know, do you want your roads paved? Or, you know, So this is something that I think the managerial staff will look at the beginning of next year and then come to council and have council discuss. I think it's really important that we discuss it before the budget process next year, because if you do it during the budget process, then you pretty much come up with a knee-jerk solution, because it's like, oh, we got to get the budget done, you know, let's just fix, you know, Band-Aid this. And so hopefully we can, earlier in the first half of 2014, think about different ways that we can support, structurally support the street fund going forward. You know, there's some things that we can look at, you know, maybe look at the TBD, maybe look at going to the voters. You know, I know that sounds unpalatable, but we should at least look at it. You know, there's different things that we need to just discuss, have some real hard discussions about how are we going to afford the streets. You know, what are we going to do? Because street maintenance is a mandated municipal function. But anyway, so that's just, you know, doom and gloom, my little heads up for next year.
Daniel.
Yes.
Councilor Pettibat.
Just a question about that. You said that at the end of 2014, the fund balance would be depleted. Mm-hmm. Did staff really look at options to start funding that for 2014, putting a little bit of money aside before it gets depleted? I mean, making some maybe other choices to go, okay, funding it in 2014, just starting a little bit of a revenue stream, getting us used to it. I mean, as you said in this budget, sales tax revenue is coming up, it's budget being lower.
Pretty much our attitude has been, we've been cutting it every year for the last few years, and so this is the first year we're not cutting. And so I think the whole idea was just to be able to maintain without cutting. And so I don't think anyone was ready to start giving the money away from the general fund.
Well, we would say it's giving it away.
Well, yeah.
It's going to fund street maintenance, which you mentioned was a priority of government.
The thought was that we could make it through 2014, and that, you know, we can balance 2014, and let's give ourselves the year of 2014 to really sit down and think about, you know, what's the right way to go about this in doing it outside of the budget process.
This isn't the first time that staff has talked about it. It's not the first time that council has talked about this. This was actually, we were aware of this last year or the year before. There was some expected sales tax revenue that we talked about devoting to the street fund. But of course, the lawsuit resulted in delay of that anticipated sales tax revenue. So that is one of the areas that I know council had talked about in the past, and staff had also looked at as well. So coming up in 2015 or at the end of 2014, first revenue source would be in 2015 as a result of the development of the Walmart building. Walmart, correct? Sales tax-wise.
We might see. Well, from the construction, we'll see.
We'll see. But
money.
the regular sales tax revenue won't happen until 2015. And that has been part of our discussions
sure.
for the last couple of years.
Sure. No, I mean, I understand, you know, what's happened over the last few years of not of taking money out, not replenishing that fund. We're in a position now where it looks like the economy is improving. We have good news here with a lot of things. I just think as a council, because of where we're at now, we should look at that and possibly look at making a choice to fund in 2014. I'm not talking about high dollars. Maybe it's start getting some money in there and start the process. Maybe it's 50,000, maybe it's 25, and then look at 2015 funding. So we've got to start somewhere with that. We've been depleting over the last 4 years. I understand why. We've been in a recession. We've had to make tough choices. You know, by all accounts, we're coming out of that. We're making choices on where to put money. I would look at this fund and have that discussion for 2014 instead of waiting until the fund is depleted completely. So that's something we might discuss.
Did you go for a comment? Thank you. Councilman Kodak, that's a good point. In looking at this, my thought is the budget is so conservative, as you said. I would think that something we should put on the plan to do is as the funds come in, as funds grow larger than what we're conservatively budgeting, then we look at moving some funds around to this kind of street maintenance fund at that time. My personal thought is that, yeah, right now it's not in our budget. We'll leave it out. But knowing that during this coming year, as extra funds come available, we look at making those chunks here and there towards that fund. That's my thought. Thank you.
Okay. Special revenue fund. We have the tourism lodging tax fund. The lodging tax committee, they will designate the usage of funds and then they bring their recommendation to council and you guys adopt it. And it's anticipated to be about $75,000. That's in the preliminary budget. In some discussions with Jeff, that number may change, but it'll be within what they expect to have. Is you know, they're not going to spend any other money except the lodging tax money. The real estate excise tax fund and REIT fund, we're estimating $500,000 in revenues, and that's going to split up with $250,000 going to the street CIP fund, $150,000 going to the parks CIP fund, and then $100,000 going to the general fund parks capital maintenance, and that's in the general fund. And that $100,000, that's allowable according to a formula by the state legislation, and that's part of that temporary thing where they said we could use REIT for capital maintenance and rather than just CIP, and that sunsets at the end of 2016, so we're making use of it while we can.
Councilor Kennebec?
Yeah, question about that. I knew we could use it for capital maintenance for the parks, and we have been using it for that. Can you use it for capital maintenance of the streets?
No.
Okay.
Special revenue funds. The donation fund is expected to spend $5,100. The public safety 800 megahertz equipment fund, it's got about $2,800 left in it. And so we're just going to transfer that to the police department in the general fund. There's no need to keep it as a separate fund anymore. Transportation concurrency fund is going to transfer $1.1 million to the street CIP fund, which is nice. And then the narcotic drug buy fund has $40,000 appropriated from drug seizure funds for their secret operations. That's it for the general fund and the governmental funds. The three internal service funds are up next. First is the IT fund. Total expenses are expected to be $519,000, and that includes document management system software, which is sorely needed, because not just for the public records request, but as a management tool for staff as well. It scares me when you come across an original signed document in the bottom of a drawer. So this is, we're going to get organized. The new phone system, which is actually a cost neutral purchase, thanks to the renegotiation of all our phone contracts that Ben Wortham recently did. The money that we normally pay in phone fees monthly is going to be used to purchase, the amount he saved us from that is what's going to go to purchase this phone system. And so it's not having to bump up the total bottom line at all in this fund, which was a really nifty thing. And also there's some network infrastructure upgrades as we slowly claw our way into the millennium. The ending fund balance per the replacement schedule is $60,000 in this fund.
Councilmember Lee.
Thank you. I thought that the network infrastructure was done already. Is there more that we still have to do?
Yeah, I can tell you what they are. Ben did a nice little sheet for me. $12,500 for PC replacements. There will be 10 of them. $3,600 for fiber redundancy from the fire department to snowpack at $300 per month. $8,850 for OS upgrades, 75 of them. $24,000 for the Office 2010 upgrade. That's the software upgrade. Let's see, the new phone system, $15,000. Traffic counter software, $700. Oh, ITS network hardware, $30,000. Building upon 2013 network infrastructure upgrades. Implement VMware, HA, high availability. This provides server and CPU box hardware failover. It does not provide storage failover as it utilizes a SAN VMware network essentials, $5,000. Cisco HA appropriate.
Well, you answered. I was assuming that that meant server upgrades.
Yeah,
that
makes sense. Done. Yeah, we're going to virtual servers now, I guess.
And you answered my next question, which is, do we have any PC replacements and stuff in there?
Okay.
So I was just looking for more detail there. It looks like you just read it off.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm a user.
Thank you.
I'm not dead.
And last question, maybe this is for Ben, he's not here. Did I hear you say Office 2010 upgrade?
Yeah.
Are we moving to 2010?
Yeah.
Okay.
Third.
What? Why 2010 and not
365?
Just. Okay, maybe I'll reach out to Ben on that.
Yeah, please do.
That's old.
I just got it today, and I'm like, whoop-de-doo, so.
In some places, it's not.
Actually, in 2003.
Some people are. I don't know.
Okay.
2010 versus.
Any more for IT?
No, thank you.
Okay. Okay. Fleet equipment. Total expenses are $1.4 million. This includes fuel of $149,000. Maintenance service charges, $200,000, and then scheduled replacements, $800,000, which leaves us with an ending fund balance for the replacement schedule of $2.2 million, which is really nice. The new replacement schedule that the Finance Committee worked so hard on, it's working. We're, you know, replacing vehicles as they are needed rather than, you know, being unsafe. And in the past... Yeah, and so, yeah, and the ending fund balance is after all those expenses are made. So that's a nice ending fund balance for that fund, especially when you consider all the fleet equipment that we have. Facility management fund, total expenses are $1.2 million, and this includes utilities on all our facilities, the street lighting charges, and all building maintenance and repairs. This covers things like, you know, HVAC systems, patching the roof. This does not put money aside for new buildings. That's would be a whole different discussion with CIP and financing. And this is strictly maintaining what we have. And the ending fund balance for the replacement schedule is $55,000 after all expenses are made. And so we're on target with this fund as well. So in summary, the revenues are making a small comeback as the economy crawls out of a recession. We're still not out of the woods yet. Small changes have been made to operations to prepare for our future growth needs. But this budget proceeds cautiously into the new economy. And the utility and CIP funds will be done next Tuesday. In the past, government finances would cycle 2 years behind the public. Like when the mortgage bubble burst, government hit it 2 years after. But we are now in uncharted economic times. And so I can't say that we're going to recover 2 years behind the public. I don't know what's going to happen. This is a guessing game for everyone. Hopefully we will rebound with the economy. We'll see how it goes. And in case any of this didn't make sense, it's not supposed to.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you.
Thank you, Wilson.
Any questions
related to this? Not, you've got another subject that you'd like to discuss with us?
Well, I wouldn't like to discuss it, but I will discuss it. This is not a happy thing. I sent all of you an email today, but maybe some of you didn't get to your emails. I'm not sure how to enter this. There's a senior housing apartment complex on 864 Village Way. It's got 39 units in it, and it's low-income seniors. It's subsidized by HUD, and it's owned by the Senior Services of Snohomish County, which is a nonprofit organization. And it came to our attention, Friday was when it came to our attention, that it's been on our utility billing system since July of 1998, and all along it's been billed incorrectly as a commercial rather than a multifamily unit, which means we have been way under billing them. And our guess is that it was probably something verbally done to try to give these people a break, because it is low-income seniors. These are people that make decisions between eating or getting their meds. And so the way our utility billing structure is right now, on multifamily units, we charge the base fee for water and sewer per unit. And what we're doing on this building is we're just charging them one base fee plus consumption. And so what it would do if we charge them the way we're supposed to, or the way our code says to, it would bump their bill up $4,300 a month or $51,000 a year. And I reached out and talked to them, and they flat out don't have the money. They just don't have it. In fact, right now they said they're sitting on their bills because since they're HUD subsidized and the federal government's shut down, they're not getting their money from HUD either. So I sort of kicked them when they were down. And so I had sent an email to Zach going, is there any loophole in our code somewhere? But I don't think there is. And so what my proposal is to you, and what I'm asking council is, and please stop me if I haven't told Zach this, and so if I'm saying something that is not allowed, please stop me. But what I'd like to do, I know council is planning on doing a water rate study at the end of 2014, the latter half of 2014. We're going to do a utility rate study and look at our structure then. But as a Band-Aid fix until then, I am proposing that we amend the code and have a new class of customer that are called nonprofits that provide housing for low-income seniors. And you'd have to meet all those things. You'd have to be a nonprofit, and you'd have to provide housing to low-income and senior. They have to meet all of that, and, you know, not rich seniors, it has to be low-income seniors, and not just low-income, it has to be low-income seniors. And so what that would do is there's only three properties in our city that would fall under this category, and that would be one of them. And the other two are the it's 601 Elizabeth Street and 701 Elizabeth Street, the Fairview Apartments. And if those two were billing right now, according to our code, and so what it would mean is if they went under this new thing, we would lose about $6,000 a month. But I kind of feel like the utility could probably absorb that. And so I'm asking if you would be willing to entertain that. And if you are willing to entertain that, I know council doesn't like to be pushed into a corner and rushed to make a decision, but since we are now aware of the situation, we are bound by the code to enforce it and to bill them the larger amount. And so I would like very much to bring an ordinance to you next week and have you waive the first reading and just adopt it, so that way it would be in effect before the next billing cycle. And so I know I'm asking a lot here, but I just really feel like we can't do this to these people. But yeah, that's all I have to say.
City Attorney Lowe.
And I'd be happy to look into that. Ms. Nelson did send me an email yesterday, I believe. It's a fairly complex issue, and it will probably take me at least a few days to come up with an answer for the city. I think the crux of the Band-Aid fix proposition, as I understand it, is whether or not the city can establish a rate classification specific to a nonprofit slash elderly.
Yeah, nonprofit operating housing for low-income seniors.
And I'll provide a response to the city in the next couple of days on that. The larger picture issue is one that will probably take a little more time than that. But now that I understand your time frame, I'll be happy to respond.
So we will look. I guess we're asking if what Diane's asking here for is whether or not to bring this. Well, I propose we're bringing this back at the next meeting. It will be up to council to decide at that time whether they'll waive any rules or waive council rules and make a decision. So just kind of a heads up that we'll bring back something next week. Hopefully.
Yeah, I was just going to say I'd like to see that right next week.
Full disclosure, the way this came about, a few council meetings ago, Zach Valspinoza came to the city and wanted to talk to you about redoing. He owns the apartment building next to this senior building, and he does not like the fact that we're billing him per unit. And he wants the council to, you know, redo their rate structure for that. And in his journeys, he got a hold of their bill, and he was the one who discovered that we were billing them differently. And he said, well, how come their bill's cheaper and mine's not? And that's when we were like, oh, shoot. I wasn't even aware that this account was being billed this way, because it's been going on since it was inception in 1998. And so he has asked that I... he said, well, what's council going to do about the rate structure and all? And so I have put on an agenda sheet on the November 19th council meeting just to ask, it's just a question, ask council, do you want to continue with doing the rate structure in the second half of 2014, or do you want to bump that project up sooner, is what I'm asking you on the, it's just to get confirmation or direction from council either way. But that's on the November 19th. And that's a separate issue than this thing where we're this one particular building.
Councilmember Gale.
So we have nothing on the record that shows how we haven't.
I searched through everything. We went back into the back archives and everything. We pulled the original building permit file. Council did give a break. We found the old minutes. Where council did give them a break on their capital connection fees for water and sewer, but there's nothing about the monthly utility billing.
Mm-hmm. Diane, you're not done yet. Ordinance saying the property tax levy for treaty. You tried.
So, yeah, this is, ordinance does not include the 1% increase. It's same levy as last year plus new construction. And it's required to be to the council by the end of November. And it allows us to levy taxes for next year.
So the recommended action tonight is a motion to accept as a first reading the ordinance setting property tax levy for 2014. I'm not quite sure who was first. Councilman Gregory.
Thank you. I appreciate the fact that this is not an increase in property taxes for this. So I will move to accept the first reading of the ordinance setting property tax levy for 2014.
All right, motion has been made by Councilman Geary, seconded by Councilmember Hanford to accept the first reading of the ordinance setting property tax levy for 2014. Attorney Mel, do you have the official ordinance title?
I believe I do, Mr. Chairman. You have to read it before you can.
Please, thank you.
City of Monroe, Ordinance Number 015-2013, an ordinance of the City of Monroe, Washington, fixing the amount of taxes to be levied by the city for the calendar year 2014.
Any questions or comments for Seeing no lights, hearing no comments, we'll vote on the motion at this time. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right, moving on to unfinished business. First is the discussion of social media policy. And that is City Administrator Bradshaw.
Thank you, Mayor. We've talked about this in the past, and it's recently been reviewed and discussed with the council committee, legislative committee. After looking at a couple of examples, the city of Seattle, the city of Cheney, and looking at what policies they had in place, doing some research, we went ahead and drafted a social media policy from those two examples. Following further review, we have decided or concluded that with our existing staffing levels, our existing budgets, we do not have the capability currently to be able to do that exact policy that both Seattle and Cheney currently do. As an alternate to that, we are proposing to utilize our existing website. There are controls that we currently do not use where we can broadcast on Twitter, Facebook. We can also blog via our website, and everything that is done using our website is recorded. We can pull up past records for records management, records requests, things of that nature. If council or staff members would like to do some blogging, those items would go through the city clerk's office, and she would approve those messages prior to posting them. Any responses from the public would come back via a city email address, so we could record that as well and track those should we get public records request. So that's what we're looking at currently. Should this be a avenue the city council would like to go, we would put together a policy reflecting that. And we have had some discussions with the city attorney, and just going over it at first blush here today seems supportive of what direction we are going. So we're looking for questions.
Councilor Pettit.
Thank you. Gene, thank you for taking a look at this and, you know, looking at a way to make it work. I've been one that's been a proponent of having effective ways to interact with residents, and we have quite a bit of residents on Facebook and social media, and we know it's here to stay, so it's, and I understand the limitations that the city has as far as staffing, and so I appreciate as a council member looking at this again and looking at ways it can work. I do have a couple questions because you obviously have the freedom of expression that's guaranteed under the Constitution, freedom of speech and all of that, and there's a couple places here where it says, at the discretion of council, mayor, or city administrator, social media application tools or sites may be limited or banned if they can't be in compliance. My assumption in reading that is social media that's being used through the city, what you're defining in here, using city resources. If you have a social media site that's using city resources and you're putting out there that you're a city council person or elected official using city resources, there are strict guidelines. Obviously, you can't have campaign issues on that. That needs to be kept totally separate and all of that. But I guess I'm a little unclear, and maybe the attorney can help with just knowing that we can't infringe on somebody's freedom of expression to have a social media site if it's not using city resources or not that. So where is the line, I guess?
I'm not sure that there is actually a bright line.
Sure.
Obviously, every situation turns on its own facts. Two things. First of all, I believe the policy you're looking at is one the city's not moving forward with. Is that kind of the fundamental background piece that I think might be?
Oh, I guess I was under this understanding that some things were added in here to talk about that that only certain things were used. So this is not the policy with the changes. This is the old policy that was looked at. Okay.
Right.
Okay, so you will be bringing back a policy that talks about using the city email as a way to monitor and make sure we meet public records requests.
Correct, and Liz can bring that up on the screen for council to look at this evening, so you can be able to see exactly what it would look like. And there is a city back in Tennessee, I believe, that has these components working in their community, which is pretty much what you guys want to do, at least what we've derived from the conversations.
Okay, because I was just confused because on page 3 it has kind of a different font, and it just says specifically set up using their official city email address as contact point. So that's in this, but that's how you're talking we should proceed. And that we should...
Correct. The policy that we put in the packet was the old policy that we were heading towards, and then once we looked at what Seattle was doing and the costs
sure.
to the community, we felt we couldn't do that. So
okay.
we set this policy aside. We kept it in the packet just so you knew where we were and where we are today.
Okay. Thank you.
Sorry for the confusion.
No, that's my bad.
Thank you, Councilmember Gary.
I don't remember what I was going to say. I didn't even realize what was on.
Okay. So we're looking at a policy, a new policy coming forth back, or coming back to council, specifically around the use of our current systems, our website, and emails.
Correct. That would be staff's recommendation, and if you would like to look at it, spend a couple minutes to see what it would look like, we'd be happy to show you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, so Brad did a little reconnaissance here on other cities that are using Civic Plus, which is who hosts our website, to see how they use the tools that are available. So this is Lakeland, Tennessee, and it looks like they're using it in the way that we would recommend for you all to use, and it looks like they're getting a maximum use out of what is out there. So you can see on this page it's showing all blog. So there's actually an option to have multiple blogs, so you could have one blog just as council members, or you could have an individual blog for each council member. And likewise, staff members could have individual blogs. And on this page, they would all show together. So this would be sort of an all look you can see from different sources.
I'm sorry, could you clarify that? So you could have a blog where all council members are contributing? Is that what you just said, or did I misunderstand?
Show up to you.
Show
all. No,
show.
But they have them?
No.
Okay.
I'm saying that would be an option that you could speak about as far as how you would want to move forward in this format. So that's just kind of their blog page overview of how it would look on the page. And then if you go to the city Facebook page, you would see how down here the blog would then be reposted as a notification on Facebook, and the goal here is it's a secondary posting. The original information is all on our website, which is already backed up, and we already are able to manage those records, which is the most important part. So all of the information that's posted on Facebook is secondary, and it's not a primary record. Likewise, on Twitter, you can see down here, same sort of posting. It brings you right back to the web page and the blog, but it gives the general information that would go out on Twitter. But again, it's secondary information, not primary, so it would cover the records piece as far as management and also for any disclosure requests.
So we'll be bringing back some more information with the policy and take a further look at this at that time.
Yes, if this is the direction the council would like to go in, that would be our intention.
Existing council members that are running for office in 2014, and whether or not if the vote was taken to increase salaries after the election, would it apply to those individuals, or if we voted on it prior to the election, would it apply? We've turned that over to Attorney Lau, and he can give his interpretation on the findings.
Thank you. Council, this is governed by Washington statute and two sections of the Washington State Constitution. And in answer to the question that I believe Councilmember Williams raised, the statutory and constitutional prohibition applies to any council member who votes to increase his or her salary during his or her term of office, and that is a virtual categorical prohibition unless the city sets up a salary commission. Under the Constitution, it is also prohibited to have the salary increase effective for any council member who votes after his or her election occurs, but before the new term, under the same principle. So in answer to your question, Councilmember Williams, for council members who are elected this November, if the city were to delay voting on the increase for salaries at a point after the election occurs, the salary increase could not affect that council member's next term. They would have to wait until after a subsequent election.
City Administrator Rosen.
Thank you, ma'am. A little more on this topic. We talked to the council level as how often this would be reviewed, procedures around that, and at the committee level, we kind of had that discussion. We decided that would be best fit in the council rules of procedure. We could add a category and address that specific topic. In regards to action, we also want to move forward on the salary proposal. The quandary that we're in is if we'll bring it back next week for the first reading of the ordinance. Typically, we do two readings. If you heard this evening, that council typically doesn't like to set aside the rules of procedure. But in this particular case, if we were going to pass this and have it active for 2014 for all the council members that it would apply to, we'd have to do the first and second next week. We also looked at coming back on the 29th to do the second reading. However, the problem with that is there's a five-day offset for the actual ordinance to become law, so there was concerns about the timing on that. So we do have it on the council agenda for next week to have the first reading, but we could do first and final should council
want to go in that direction.
Councilmember Gamble.
One of the questions that was posed when we did discuss this last time is, you know, hey, where we came with a number and, you know, and a recommendation, and how did you, you know, arrive at that number? And you can see that that's in the documentation now. That's basically, you know, over 80% was on a monthly salary, and the average compensation is 582.43 a month. So we were pretty spot on with our number there that we came. Well, we'll be coming back next week. It'll be up to council at that time to decide whether they want to change waiver rules or procedures after hearing what City Attorney Lowell shared this evening.
So will it be presented on the agenda that way then? Kind of like it was tonight, to, there was an item to waive as one and then as the second. So we would expect to see it that way next week?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Just for the city attorney, so it's the election, it's not the certification of the election.
It's one of the points that I'll be looking into, but the constitutional provision simply refers to the term election, and I'll be happy to research that further, but I'm not aware of any specific case law off the top of my head that has construed that one way or the other in this context.
Thank you.
Councilmember Gans.
We talked about that in committee, and obviously we didn't have Zach, you know, and when we were talking, we just didn't think it really sent the right message to be voting, because basically you would be, if you were going to do it, it would be November 5th, or, you know, the day of the election. That just isn't, I know we've asked for public, and we had the public hearing, we really haven't, you know, got any negative, you know, and obviously when you look at the, you know, the data, it stands up, but right. I just thought the more time that you could give to say, hey, we can do this, and you have a week and a half, you know, in between the, you know, actual election, it would just make more sense. But if we wait until after, and there are members that get reelected, you know, the incoming folks would have that, you know, raise, and you'd have people there for 4 years without it, and I think that's so anyway. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll be back to you next week with recommendations, and look forward to council action. So, I think we got through everything this evening. We do have some departmental reports that I hope that you were able to look at. Jake, did he take off? Anything to add this evening, Brad, to the report that's...
Just as I mentioned last week, the Skypeno Water Association voted to merge with us and we sent the materials off to the appropriate government agencies for review and approval. And hopefully that won't take too awfully long. The only thing that's going to take a while is the franchise agreement for us to have rights to have the pipes and county roads. And supposedly that won't be able to get to the county council until January. So.
And Diane, you have the donation tracking report in the packet tonight. Anything to add to that?
Not
right
now.
All right. Then we'll continue with staff reports. Jeff, anything?
Forgive me for hearing something wrong earlier, but I wanted to make a clarification if I could. Council member Cutback asked the question. Can you use the maintenance, the REIT dollars that normally go to parks for capital on the roadside? The answer to that question is yes. It's not no. That the money was dedicated for operational expenses in the parks department. And so you can always use REIT money for capital projects on the park side or the roadside.
Yeah. No, my question was, could we use it for maintenance, not necessarily capital, but street maintenance on the street side?
And I believe there are certain types of maintenance activities that can be REIT dollars used for. But I just want to clarify that. So Maybe I'm off.
I thought you were going to point out something I was doing wrong.
No. Maybe I just misheard. So forgive me for mishearing something. Other than that, all is good. I would have to say the health of our community is good, and there we are.
Very good. All right. Mike?
Thank you. I just want to point out that over at the Rotary Field, the wall, that's a signature wall there, and most of you, if not all of you, have seen that wall. We've had some problems in the past with, we had some pretty bad graffiti that occurred there, and also there was a condition called efflorescence where you had, like, a little chalky white chalk was coming out, and it's just kind of with the ceiling of the top of the wall. Well, anyways, the Rotary Club has stepped up, and they just this last weekend, they have professionally stained the wall to match the color. That really addresses where we need to go from here with maintaining that wall with the graffiti. Because, you know, you can pressure wash it, but you're always going to have that mark. You can tell something happened on that wall. So they had that done, and they also sealed the top of the wall too, to address more of the efflorescence issue. And they're doing that at no cost to the city. So it's a donation value of approximately $2,000. So I really appreciate the Monroe Rotary Club for stepping up and helping us out.
Great. Thank you. Chief?
Two things. Last night, the mayor and I attended a domestic violence vigil at the held at the Catholic Church. I think there was about 100 and some people in attendance. Specifically, it was honoring victims of domestic violence and the young lady that lost her life at Lewis and Maine this summer. And the second thing I have is last Thursday, all day long, we were receiving phone calls from a male individual who had his vehicle seized the night before by us. And he was making threats such as, I'll see you in court and the like. Well, Friday morning, about 2 o'clock in the morning, he decided to test our new impound lot security system. He did quite well until he decided to stand up. But he assisted us in removing the drugs from his vehicle. really didn't need much of a search warrant after that. We captured him, and we also appreciate very much he pointed out the weak points in our security system and our impound yard, and we are addressing those. And he, last I heard, he was resting comfortably in the county facility.
Councilmember reports. Councilmember Gary.
Thanks. Yeah, I had a great time at homecoming this last week. The football game was a win, which was great. A winning touchdown thrown by someone specialty, of course. It was a great time. Just a little disappointing for me, of course, the bane of my existence here in town is addresses. A disappointing letter to me. The post office actually did a little survey of the area on Roosevelt Road. As you know, people on Roosevelt Road have a Snohomish address, and yet they live in the city of Monroe, which, well, the bane of my existence. The survey said they would like to keep it as Snohomish or Washington 98290. So there you have it. And there ends my quest. I'm not really surprised. It only adds to our 6 different addressing systems that we have here in town. So there we go. It is. I just thought I'd throw that out there. But done now. There you go. There you have it. Thank you.
That's a record.
I'm going to miss.
What's that?
Honestly, you're going on the record that that's the last you'll be speaking of it this year.
He already said that.
Yes.
This is a different one. This was USPS.
Go back.
That means I won't.
Thank you, Councilmember.
Thank you. Attended the Fire District's open house on Saturday. It was a great event. Just kudos to the personnel there. They did a wonderful job. Very educational. My kids loved it. I loved it. So just kudos to that.
Councilmember Williams?
No.
Councilmember? Councilmember Davis?
No.
Councilmember Young?
Homecoming was fantastic. I just wanted to echo that.
The kind
missed the winning touchdown because my son had, I know, had that game the next day, which, by the way, gave me the line. 26-0. Yeah, I had a great town event. They had, you know, the tailgate beforehand. All the different clubs were represented there for a while. It was just a great, great town event.
Thank you, Councilmember Henry.
Yes, I also attended homecoming. It was wonderful. I was very proud of my son, who, being on the ASB, was part of being responsible for the halftime presentations and King and Queen and everyone. So I was very proud to see him at work. Also went to the candlelight vigil last night and was very, it was a very moving evening. So I thought everyone did a great job in their speaking.
Just to echo the event last night, was touching. It was in memory of Jacoba Ramirez Rodriguez, and she was tragically killed as a result of domestic violence. But in that, I think that the message was twofold. One, that she will not be forgotten. Her life, the light of her life continues in the lives her family and friends as they remember her, and as we did last and honored her last night. But also, as was poignantly stated or communicated by our county executive, who was also in attendance last night, you know, it's the responsibility, or it's time for men to stand up and end this. Typically. Or predominantly the accusers or those who are are the
perpetrators,
that's right. And so I appreciated his words last night, as well as a number of folks. One of the things that, you know, Chief, that I really appreciated, and I would love to see that ceremony again, was Pastor Mack and his wife. I can't remember what Pastor Mack's last name is.
Taylor.
Yes, and his wife did a tribute to the officers who, whatever you call them, the guards.
The honor guard.
The honor guard. And that was really fascinating to hear the history behind that. It's really cool. So we might invite them here to share that. So it was a great evening. Great evening overall, in the sense that the community was brought together under unfortunate circumstances, but all working towards the end of the tragedy called domestic violence. So I was very honored to be part of that. City Administrator Braswell.
Yeah, today Diane and I had the opportunity to attend the City Administrators and Managers meeting that we have once a month, and County Executive John Lovick was also in attendance, and the guest speaker today was the new State Auditor, Mr. Kelly, and it was very encouraging to see the model that they've been aiming for under his administration. It's all about customer service. They're there for all of us. It was just a total different view of the Auditor's Office than we've seen over the past many years. So that was very refreshing. He's a very involved manager, and I think that, you know, anytime there's issues at city level or anybody has questions, he definitely encourages all of us to reach out to his office. So anyway, that was a good meeting today, and we were very encouraged of the direction that they're heading. So I wanted to share that.
I like to think that it's a result of the auditors who came to the city in Monroe and saw what was modeled here, taking those reports back to the State Auditor's Office and having it in back. So, yeah. We'll take credit, right? Thank you.
Absolutely. Draft agenda, October 22nd, 2013. Announcements and presentations. We have the Wastewater Treatment Plant Outstanding Performance Award. 2012. Recognition for 20 years of service, Sergeant Rick Dunn. A proclamation for Police and Fire Appreciation Week, November 17th through the 23rd. We have the consent agenda. Under unfinished business, we have an ordinance increasing council compensation. It will be the first and final reading, should we go that direction. Number two, discussion traffic calming program. Under new business, we have review of 2013 comprehensive plan, East Monroe addendum, or amendment, excuse me. Presentation of utility funds and CIP funds for budget. Adopt pay for performance policy for non-represented employees. We talked about that briefly this evening. Authorized purchase of new phone system. We also spoke of that just briefly this evening. Under final action, we have the ordinance setting property tax levy, second and final reading, and the draft agenda for November 12th, 2013. Additions or deletions?
Made by Councilmember Hanford, seconded by Councilmember Cutaback. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.